If you would, open up to Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13. If you look down in verse 53, you'll notice what's been going on, of course, through most of this chapter. It says, when Jesus had finished these parables, he departed from there. And you think about Jesus teaching through these seven different kingdom parables, kingdom of heaven, specifically in the Gospel of Matthew. And the comparisons that he makes, the reason for the parables is to keep hidden things hidden. And the aspects of these parables that even his own disciples didn't understand them until Jesus was willing to sit down and explain the parable of the sower, to explain the parable of the wheat and the tares. And in doing that, they get insight into what's going on and to realize if you really want to understand insight into anything, we should appeal to Jesus and be attentive to his words. Because what Jesus unravels just in the explanation of those two parables really helps us to grasp what's going on in so many of the other parables as well. It's as if, and Mark's account brings it out more clearly, Jesus says, if you don't understand this, how will you understand all the parables? As if to say that the parable of the sower is really kind of a map legend key for unlocking and seeing some of the imagery and things that he uses, as these things were intended to keep hidden things hidden. But yet to his disciples, he would explain them. And so here he's been by the Sea of Galilee explaining these parables. And he says, and he departed from there. And you think he's going to travel from where he was on the Sea of Galilee, and he's going to come to his hometown, and specifically talking about Nazareth. And remember, Nazareth means dedicated. And ironically, that was not its reputation among most people. You might think about the Gospel of John when Nathanael says, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? I mean, Nazareth is not seen as a place of, oh, that's the best place to be from. It's almost seen as a trash heap, not in how it looked, but in terms of the character of the people, of going, can anything good come from there? As if I've never seen anything good come from there. And so here's Jesus, verse 54. Says he came to his hometown, of course, talking about Nazareth. He says, and began teaching them in their synagogue, so that they were astonished and said, where did this man get this wisdom and these miraculous powers? Notice what hits them. What are they asking? Where did this come from? Like, where did he get this kind of wisdom? And where did he get this kind of power? Now, in Mark's account, in Mark 6, the first several verses of the chapter is the parallel of what's here in Matthew 13. And over in Mark's account, at the end of chapter 5, Jesus just raised somebody from the dead. So understand some of these events that are taking place, you go, he's really done some quite marvelous things in raising someone from the dead. I mean, almost unheard of in the history of mankind, except for a few examples in the Old Testament. And going, here he is. Now he comes to his hometown of Nazareth, and they're listening to what he's saying, and he's teaching them in their synagogue. So what does that say about who the listeners are? Jews? What else do you know about them? If they're at the synagogue, you don't really know about necessarily Pharisees or Sadducees, but going, these are people who come to worship God, right? These aren't the people who say, yeah, we're Jewish in lineage, but we don't really go to the synagogue. These are people who actually are putting forth an effort to worship God. And so here they are being at the synagogue, and Jesus is teaching them, and it says, and so that they were astonished. And they were astonished at his teaching. Now, I want you to, the literal translation of this astonishment is, it struck them. Like it really, we would say, it made an impression. That's kind of our terminology. You think about striking like a coin to make an impression on a die. So for them, they're going, this is making an impression on us. Now, that doesn't mean everything was going great, but you start to notice this idea, and a similar word is used in other places in the gospel accounts, like whenever Jesus calms the storm on the Sea of Galilee, he talks about the disciples were astonished. It made a mark on them. They remembered that event. You know, we probably live, you know, all these days that we've lived, there are many days in your life you probably don't have any recollection of. But there are some days in your life that you will never forget. And to go for those men on the boat, whenever it was calmed at Jesus' word, it made an impression on them. And that same word for astonished is what you have here. So what Jesus is teaching in the synagogue, it's making an impression on them. This is one of those days that they're not going to forget. However, notice their question in this astonishment is, where did this man get this wisdom? You could almost imagine having some men and women who would have been considerably a few decades older than Jesus and go, I remember him when he was just a little boy. And sometimes in doing that, you kind of rob people of the way you look at them. Not always. But going, you know, you think about somebody who's 20 years older than Jesus and going, I remember whenever he was just a, I remember him crying when his mom would hold him. You know, those kind of things. And so where did he get this kind of wisdom? Which also tells you a little something about whenever Jesus was a child. Now, we know the stories in Luke chapter 2 about that he grows in wisdom, he grows in stature, he grows in favor with God and man. He kept increasing. And you go, okay, he's making some big strides. Like by the time he's 12, he already understands his mission to some extent. And then going, but yet while he was a child, how was he seen by the people of Nazareth? Just a boy. They didn't go, oh, yeah, he's finally come home. We knew he was a prodigy whenever he was studying Scripture. They're not saying that. They're saying, where'd he get this wisdom? This is not the boy we knew. And then the other aspect of this is, and these miraculous powers, where'd that come from? Then they go on with this, verse 55. Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary and his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? Notice how they saw him. They saw him in light of his father's occupation. If you read this same account in Mark, it'll say, is this not the carpenter? It doesn't say the carpenter's son. It says, is this not the carpenter? Which there are similarity in terms of you would typically be an apprentice of what your father did. Maybe you think in terms of James and John. Their father was also a fisherman. And so you would hand these trades down. And so here it is. Is not this the carpenter's son? Like, isn't he just a carpenter? Like, where would he get all this wisdom? And, you know, your mind kind of goes in a lot of different directions. And we're probably a little fleshly in the way we think about it. If you think about Jesus being a carpenter, how do you imagine the furniture he would make? How would you imagine him as being a carpenter, the furniture that he would make? How would it look? We usually kind of think of, man, it would be just stunning. But we only think that because we think of him as being perfect. Did he have to make beautiful furniture to be perfect? No. And yet realize sometimes we read these things into it. But notice for them, they recognize him as he's the carpenter. So here in Matthew 13, verse 55, it says, is not this the carpenter's son? And it's not as if carpenters were the highest elevated people in the community. And whatever he would make in terms of whether it be furniture or whether it be yokes for oxen or whether it would be other things out of wood, he says, is not his mother called Mary? Like, isn't Mary his mother? It's almost as if there's been a little bit of a disconnect, like, that's right. I mean, have you ever done that with somebody? I know them. Is their mother this person? And you kind of wonder, like, I think that's the case, but he says, and then specifically they can even list off his brothers, James and Joseph and Simon and Judas. And then verse 56, and his sisters, plural, are they not all with us? Where then did this man get all these things? So if you think about Jesus here, just being very conservative of going, you know, Jesus is the oldest of the brothers, since he's the only one born of a virgin. Then you have James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas. That's a total of five sons for Mary. And then at least two sisters, because it says sisters, plural. So that could be two, and it could keep on going up from there. But to go, here's Jesus who's raised in a household, and there's seven siblings among them. He doesn't come from a small house. And on a carpenter's wage, the more kids you add to a small wage, what happens? You realize you don't necessarily grow up with affluence, do you? Hey, times can be hard. And yet, here they are. And so they look at him and look at, they can call the brothers by name, the sisters, all of them apparently still lived in Nazareth. He says, are they not all with us? He says, where then did this man get all these things? And all these things that they're referring to is what? Wisdom and power. He says, where does that come from? We know his family. They're not known for being the wisest people in the city. Whether that was true or not, I can't tell you. But the perception of how they were seen was not one of great wisdom. And then power says, this is not like his brothers. He's not like his brothers. And his sisters, we know all of them. He says, where'd this man get all these things? Then verse 57. And out of all this thinking, now remember, the teaching was so astonishing that it struck them. It made a mark on them. But then all of a sudden you turn around and they start wondering, is that really true? Is he really qualified? Can we believe what he's saying? We know his family. We know his occupation of his father. We know him as a carpenter too. He worked as a carpenter apparently until before he started his public ministry. And then you get to verse 57, and they took offense at him. They're offended. Now, what's kind of curious is the word offense here is not an active word. It's a passive word. Let's just think about it for a second. It wasn't they were going, we don't like him. It's they were offended in a passive way. Like maybe what you would do if somebody, I'm going to take this to a negative place. If somebody was racist, and all of a sudden you find out that you have some medical condition, and you desperately need help in this medical condition, and you set up an appointment over the phone to meet with this specialist, and then you walk into the office, and you're waiting, and you filled out all the paperwork, and everything's been turned in, you've seen the nurse, you're waiting on the doctor to come in, and then all of a sudden, being racist, the doctor comes in and they're of that race. And now you become offended. You're not offended because of who they are. You're offended because of who you are. You're the one that has the racist problem, not them. And so you understand here, I'm not saying they're racist against Jesus. They're saying the way they think about him and his family, and to think that wisdom and power could come out of them, they're just offended. Now, it says they took offense at him, and it's because of what's inside of them. It's not because of who Jesus is. And what's so amazing, what's so marveling about it is his teachings are so striking, and yet because of what's in them, it doesn't change them. Isn't that something? Now, he says, and they took offense at him. Now, just stop there for a second and remember this statement. Come back just a few chapters to Matthew chapter 11. And it's as if Matthew wants us to go back and think about this, because the terminology is the same. Of course, if you remember, the two disciples come from John the Baptist. They're sent by John to say, ask Jesus, not because John's doubting this at all, because Jesus is going to praise John for who he is and what he's done. And they come and they ask Jesus, are you the expected one or should we look for somebody else? And Jesus says, look around and see. What do you see? And of course, the deaf hear, the blind see, the lame, the dead are raised, all these kind of statements. And then here's John, who's sitting in a prison, and he's not going to be delivered. And you get this little statement in verse 6, Matthew 11, verse 6. And this is part of what Jesus sends through these disciples to go back to John. And blessed is he who does not take offense at me. And this is the exact same Greek word that's here in verse 6 that's over in chapter 13 that we were just reading. He says, blessed is he who does not take offense at me. So what does that mean about people who are offended by Jesus? Is there any blessing? No. What do you get instead? A curse. Because if you turn away the only option for life, what are you left with? Death, spiritual death. Now, of course, here the idea is for John, John's not going to be delivered from prison. He's going to die there, and that's where Matthew 14 is going to go next. But seeing the aspect of this, blessed is he who's not offended by me. What about whenever God doesn't do things on my terms? Will I be offended by that? Because if I'm offended by what God's doing in my life, who's really the problem? We look at him in the mirror, don't we? It's us. Now, using this thought, blessed is he who does not take offense at me. And this word for blessed is one that is about favor from God. And it's about you will have this favor as long as you have the right attitude. And the attitude here is, I'm not going to be offended by God. If I'm in a car accident and I can't walk again ever in my life, am I going to be offended by God? Or is God going to find some way for me to imitate him that's going to be useful in his kingdom? It changes the way we start to think. Now, come back over to Matthew chapter 13. Here are a bunch of hometown people in Nazareth who had, some of whom had probably been around there whenever Jesus was growing up. And all of a sudden, they hear Jesus' teachings. They're very striking to him, but they're offended by them. Where did he get this kind of wisdom? Where did he get this kind of power? And they're offended at him. And once again, this offense is a passive, so it means it's because of what's inside of them that's the problem. It's not what Jesus is doing. And so many times there can be that kind of offense. And you see that, we'll see it in the Gospel of Matthew a couple of times where it talks about with the Pharisees, Jesus would say something and his disciples says, don't you know that the Pharisees were offended by that? And Jesus says, let the blind lead the blind. He says, there are times where things is just right. It's the right thing. It's just the wrong listener because of their hard heart and they get offended. Okay, that's all right. If there's no other right way to do it, choose the right way to do it. And if it offends people, it offends people. There are other times where you see Jesus go, there's another way where we can do this, and it doesn't have to be offensive. And sure enough, he chooses the other way. So you start to look at this idea when he says, and they took offense at him. And Jesus knew it. It wasn't as if he didn't know. And look at how he responds in verse 57. But Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and in his own household. Now, this is a bigger problem than just Nazareth. This also tells you the way that his own family sees him. Or I'll say some in his own family see it. To think, he says, I don't expect, and notice the way Jesus refers to himself as a prophet. Here I am, a prophet, trying to tell my own people what God desires, and they don't want it. And you think, ooh. He says, a prophet is not without honor, with one exception, in his own hometown. And sure enough, it's true. He's like, I'm right here. And I know you're offended by me. He didn't even have to say it. He says, and in his own household, with James and Joseph and Simon and Judas and his sisters, they go, who do you think you are? Ooh, it can be kind of tough. Oh, you're going to follow the ways of Jesus. I guess you're just better than the rest of us, huh? You ever had a statement like that in your own family? You know, what do you do? Notice what Jesus does with these kind of people. Verse 58. And he did not do many miracles there because of their unbelief. So, when you get these offensive kind of remarks, what's it time to do? Pull back. And you notice, here's Jesus. I've got to make sure I say this right. What stops Jesus from advancing in our life? Us. Our unbelief. It's not that Jesus doesn't have the power. It's not that he can't work out the situation. It's that we don't trust him to believe him. He says, forgive your family. He says, be patient. How about words of kindness and truth? And you go, how come we don't try that? It's because we don't really believe him. It's not because he hadn't said it. And instead we offer up anger and we become rude people and we wonder, how come God doesn't work this out? And you realize here he is, says, he didn't do many miracles there. And notice it doesn't say he didn't do any. It says he didn't do many. And he does it in the way that's right. That's what he does. And you realize here, he says, he had raised someone from the dead right before this in Mark's account. And so now you go, he didn't do many miracles there because of their unbelief. If you want to push God away from working in your life, here's the best way to do it. And I say best, tongue in cheek. Just don't trust him. Because why would he take care of us and reward us for not trusting him? What would that encourage? The wrong direction, wouldn't it? It would encourage distrust. It's the same thing that we do with our children, isn't it? You don't encourage them in things that are wrong. You go, all right, we're going to go in the wrong direction, wrong attitude. Just put the brakes on anything good coming your way. Now, you see this situation. Look at the next chapter. Look at chapter 14. Then we kind of get a different scene. It's almost like we know we're on the same planet, but now the focus goes somewhere else. Chapter 14, verse 1. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the news about Jesus. Heard the news. Now, I want you to see the contrast here. In Jesus' own hometown, what's their response toward Jesus? Offended, right? Yet, here is a governmental leader of Herod, and he's hearing the news about Jesus, and you'll see he has a completely different mindset. And he's a scallywag. I mean, he is just rotten. But he can see something in Jesus. Isn't that something? Now, a couple of things. Do you know what a tetrarch is? Does that mean anything to you? Okay, close. Tetrarch is about four. It's about, We would say a quarter is probably our term. But for them, they were tetrarchs. Whenever Herod the Great died a few years around 4 BC, he divided up his regions of rule between his four children, three sons and one daughter. Gives you the idea about why it's a tetrarch kind of mindset. The daughter, she kind of subsides pretty quickly and doesn't get replaced. They still call them tetrarchs, even though there's really only going to be like three major ones, just because that's what it comes to. If you read through Luke chapter 3, it's going to talk about three of the tetrarchs. One of them is going to be Herod. We know Herod Antipas. He's the one we know of as Herod through the gospel accounts as Jesus starts his ministry. Then there's his brother, Philip. And then there's going to be another one who's not part of that family, but his name is Licinius, and he's over a region called Abilene. So they kind of divide Palestine into these four regions that later really just become three. But it gives you an idea about if you're a tetrarch, it means you're over part but not the whole. So at this time, Herod, and this is Herod Antipas, the tetrarch, heard the news about Jesus, verse 2, and said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He is risen from the dead, and that is why miraculous powers are at work in him." Now, you remember the question that they had in Nazareth? Where did this wisdom come from, and where did this power come from? Just because you don't know the actual answer doesn't stop people from making up their own. Now, here's Herod. He hears about the miraculous things that Jesus is doing, and he knows how John the Baptist died because it's about to tell us the story that Herod already knew. He says, "This is John the Baptist." And the reason he has so much power is because, why? He's been raised from the dead. And you go, my goodness. The people in Nazareth have no faith whatsoever in Jesus. And yet here's Herod, who killed John the Baptist, is going, "I know why he can do all these things. He's back from the dead. He changed his name." Now, doesn't make it true, but this tells you the mindset of Herod, who is a major player in terms of political power in the land. So he tells this to his servants. He says he has risen from the dead, and that is why miraculous powers are at work in him. Verse 3. "For when Herod had John arrested, he bound him and put him in prison because of Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip." Now, what made Herod want to arrest John? It was all about divorce and marriage. And he says, you know what? He says, you'll see it here in a minute in verse 4. He says, "For John had been saying to him, 'It is not lawful for you to have her.'" And I'm going to show you here in a minute that this was a Roman law. John wasn't saying, "Hey, this is God's law about this." He's going to say, "Your own law says that you're a lawbreaker." He didn't have to say, "God says this." He says, "Your own law tells you that you're wrong. The law that you live by, the one that you govern over." He says, "You're breaking your own rules." Now, in verse 3, I want to give you a little outside perception. And that's all it is a perception. In the first century, whenever Jerusalem gets destroyed in the days of Titus, as army commander, he's not yet the Roman Caesar. Whenever he destroys Jerusalem in AD 70, there's a Jewish man who is a historian. And Titus decided, "We're going to deliver you and not kill you, and you're going to write the history from the point of view of the Jews." Now, it's not as if this man is an outstanding Jewish follower of Christ. But I just want you to see this from a general Jewish point of view. And that's all this is. How did the average Jews think about John the Baptist? Because he writes a ton. I mean, this is what his job is. And so he writes all these things. He died, he lived from about 37 AD, so he doesn't overlap with John the Baptist's life. He doesn't overlap with the life of Jesus. Flavius Josephus is the historian's name, and he dies about 100 AD. And I just want to read to you a couple excerpts. The first one is about the way that he saw John the Baptist in terms of the perception. Remember, he's a generation removed, being born in AD 37. So I just want you to think about this. And he's going to talk about something about Herod's army was completely and utterly destroyed at one point in time. And he tells you what the people even thought about that. And it goes back to John the Baptist. So I'll try and read this where you can, good enough to where you can pull it together. This comes out of, if you want a little note to go read it on your own, it's Flavius Josephus. The work is called The Antiquities of the Jews. This comes out of Book 18 and Chapter 5, and this is Section 2. So, Antiquities of the Jews, Book 18, Chapter 5, Section 2. I'm just reading it to you verbatim. I'm not going to make many comments along the way here. Now, some of the Jews thought the destruction of Herod's army came from God, and that very justly, as a punishment of what he did against John, that was called the Baptist. For Herod slew him, who was a good man, and commanded the Jews to exercise virtue, in talking about John the Baptist, both as to righteousness toward one another and piety towards God, and so to come to baptism, for that the washing would be acceptable to him if they made use of it, not in order to the putting away of some sins, but for the purification of the body. This is his misinterpretation of what John was doing. Keep that in mind. He says, but for the purification of the body, supposing still that the soul was thoroughly purified beforehand by righteousness. Now, when many others came in crowds about him, for they were very greatly moved by hearing his words, talking about the words of John, Herod, who feared lest the great influence John had over the people might put it into his power an inclination to raise a rebellion, for they seemed ready to do anything he should advise, which tells you the way they saw John. He says, thought it best by putting him to death to prevent any mischief he might cause and not bring himself into difficulties by sparing a man who might make him repent of it when it would be too late. Accordingly, he was sent a prisoner out of Herod's suspicious temper to Metrus, the castle I mentioned before in earlier writings, and was there put to death. Now, the Jews had an opinion that the destruction of this army was sent as a punishment upon Herod as a mark of God's displeasure to him. Now, isn't that something? A Jewish historian is saying the reason that Herod's army went down so hard and so fast is because of what Herod had done to one of God's own messengers, John the Baptist. And once again, Flavius Josephus is not a Christian. He's not someone who has great faith in Jesus. And yet he does write some things about Jesus, which is interesting. But you notice through here, that was kind of the perception of people about John the Baptist, just to give you a general idea. And that's just written history. It's just a perception, so don't take it for everything, like Scripture or anything. But here's the other part that I wanted to read to you. It comes from Section 4 of the same writing. In other words, The Antiquities of the Jews, Book 18, Chapter 5. Now, this I'm going to read to you part of Section 4. And this is about Herod, and this is about his brother, Philip, and the woman that they both married while both were still living. Now, listen to this. But Herodias, their sister, was married to Herod Philip, the son of Herod the Great, who was born of Merimane, that's his mother, the daughter of Simon, the high priest, who had a daughter, Salome, after whose birth Herodias took upon her to confound the laws of our country, the Roman laws, confound the laws of our country, and divorced herself from her husband while he was alive and was married to Herod Antipas. Her husband's brother, by the father's side, he was Tetrarch of Galilee, but her daughter Salome was married to Philip, the son of Herod, the Tetrarch of Trachonitis. And as he died childless, Aristobulus, the son of Herod, the brother of Agrippa, you may think about King Agrippa, tied to the Herod family later on in Acts, married her. They had three sons, Herod, Agrippa, and Aristobulus. So notice, the reason that Herod hated John the Baptist so much is because he was saying, you don't keep your own Roman laws. Well, if you don't want to do what's right, you don't like people telling you that. So, you can understand here in Matthew 14, verse 4, where it says, for John had been saying to him, notice, didn't just say it once, had been saying, like, remember, you're breaking your own laws. Like, how could you say anything against me? If I break the law, you're doing it every day. He says, for John, had been saying to him, it is not lawful for you to have her, Herodias, as his wife. Verse 5. Although Herod wanted to put him to death, he feared the crowd because they regarded John as a prophet. What did Herod want to do with John the Baptist? He wanted to kill him. I'm tired of listening to you. And I'd rather you were dead. But what kept him from doing it? Political people care about what the people think, don't they? And that's usually where it goes bad. Need to care about what God thinks. Now, he says, although Herod wanted to put him to death, he feared the crowd. Notice fear. And if you remember the way that Flavius Josephus talks about it, it was a fear in terms of thought, even the followers of John the Baptist may rise up because they would do anything that he said, which tells you about the dedication of the disciples of John from Josephus's perception. Then he says, he feared the crowd because they regarded John as a prophet. He said, he's from God. Now, then verse 6. Of course, now it tells a story about John's death. But when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod. So this is only the second time in all of Scripture that talks about somebody celebrating a birthday. And you think it goes all the way back to Pharaoh in Egypt. That was the first one. Now with Herod, this is the second one. If you remember with Pharaoh, it was his baker who died. And now you come to this story. And for that reason, some people don't even celebrate birthdays. There's some religions that don't do that. And it's because of these two stories. Now, I'm not telling you that's the way you should believe, but I'm telling you, you can understand whenever somebody says, oh, we don't celebrate birthdays. Okay, fine. You don't have to. Nobody's saying you have to. But just know that's where that belief comes from. Then, it says, but when Herod's birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod. Whatever kind of dance it was, it had his attention. It made an effect on him. Verse 7. So much that he promised with an oath to give her whatever she asked. Man, be careful about going to the dance. But you look at this and go, whatever this dance was, it pleased him to the point, and if you read it in other accounts, up to half the kingdom, which was like saying, I'll give you anything within reason. I'm not going to give you the whole kingdom. Says, what do you want? And sure enough, whatever she asked, verse 8, having been prompted by her mother. Oh, her mother cares about this too. So Herodias being the mother. Having prompted by her mother, she said, give me here on a platter the head of John the Baptist. Now, Herodias is married to Herod. Surely she knows that Herod wants to kill John the Baptist, but because of political reasons, he's afraid out of fear of the crowd. But this gives it away as how Herodias feels about John the Baptist. She just wants him dead. She doesn't care about the people. She doesn't care about the influence, which tells you something, well, not a wonderful wife in many, many different ways. And so, here's this daughter that pleases, comes and asks mom for wisdom. Oh, mom, what should I ask for? I can have anything in the kingdom. And now I want you to think about what bitterness and anger and hatred does. I mean, you could have been given anything. out of all the wonderful things you could have been given, to go, I want his head on a platter. That's what you want. He says, give me here on a platter the head of John the Baptist. Verse 9. Although he was grieved, the king, talking about Herod, the king commanded it to be given because of his oaths and because of his dinner guests. All right, I'm going to ask you the conundrum here. Verse 9, it says, although he was grieved, why is he grieved? He wanted to put him to death. Why is he grieved? His political side, his political agenda, that's a good way to put it. All of a sudden, he realizes this is really going to mess everything up. He's grieved because he's going to lose influence. And now, this has happened in such a public way that he can't say, I know I promised to give you anything, but not that. You have to be careful when you make promises. Another good example of that. He says, although he was grieved, and he's grieved because of verse 5, he feared the crowd. Because they regarded John the Baptist as a prophet. This was about the only situation where Herod was going to kill John the Baptist. And I want you to think about it. He's grieved. Not because John's going to die. He's grieved because of what he's losing in this. He says he commanded it to be given because of two things. His oath and too many witnesses. He says, and they all heard me say it. And now here it is. Verse 10. He sent and had John beheaded in the prison. Now, what you read out of Josephus talked about how that he's not in prison right there in the same town. He's in prison somewhere else. So this is going to take a bit. Word has to be sent. Judgment carried out. His judgment. Unrighteous judgment. And then the head's going to be brought back on a platter to show that the deed has been done. And so it talks about he sent and had John beheaded in the prison. I want you to think back to those words in Matthew chapter 11. Blessed is he who is not offended by me. Jesus could raise the dead. He could make the blind to see. He could make the lepers cleansed. He could have the gospel preached to the poor. But John was going to die in prison. And did John do all that God had called him to do? He did. Do you ever hear about a tragic death? Something that people say, just wrong place at the wrong time. And I'm not saying this applies to everything. But specifically in light of someone who is righteous. Sometimes we let our imaginations go where they shouldn't go. Because it'd be real easy to hear about John's death and go, I knew he didn't do it according to God. Because of how it ended for him. But who's the one missing out? Wrong perceptions on the inside. Wrong applications on the inside. Jesus, after that statement in Matthew 11, goes on to talk about John in the most wonderful ways. He says, he did what God called him to do. He says, what'd you go out in the wilderness to see? He says, you went out there to hear the words of God. He says, and out of all the men who have been born of women, and realize how many people that includes. That includes everybody, every man who's ever walked on the earth except for Adam. He's the only one not born of a woman. He says, John's better than all of them. All those who had come before. Think about who that includes in the Old Testament. Moses. Abraham. David, Elijah, I mean, Enoch, who didn't even see death. He walked with God and God took him. And you see how Jesus talks about John. Just because our lives don't end on a high note doesn't mean we didn't walk it with God. And we need to remember that for us. We need to remember that for other saints. And make sure we take that in. Now, here's John. And I mean, it doesn't give you any insight into what actually happened in the prison. Any conversations. But yet, you know, I think John was ready to go. God, will you use me however you see fit? Sometimes that doesn't mean great honor, but it does mean escape. And in whatever way John thought about it, I don't see him trembling with fear because of how Jesus talks about him. Here he is. Then, verse 11, and his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl. I can't imagine any girl having what I think of as a charger when I think about plates in the kitchen, having a head, a human head. I mean, I thought about bringing a charger and just putting a head on it. Not very pretty, especially after death. You talk about nightmares. And brought it to the girl, and her response, notice she doesn't want to keep it. She takes it to her mother. This is what you wanted. I think Herodias was pleased with herself. He's not going to say another word to me. He's not going to talk to my husband. Now, it's also tells you, when you start talking about marriage and divorce and things, sometimes a lot of folks want to cut off righteous people's heads. And they may just very well be speaking the truth. Then, verse 12, says, his disciples came and took away the body. Can you appreciate that? They don't get the head. It says, his disciples came and took away the body and buried it. And they went and reported to Jesus. In this situation, the disciples, notice, they're going to treat John with honor. They're going to take his body, and you think about how mangled that would have looked, and to bury him. And specifically here, there's specifically one person that John was always talking about. Someone who is greater than I'm not worthy to untie his sandal. We need to take word to Jesus. We need to tell him. And remember this too. John and Jesus aren't just both prophets. They're related. In some way they're related to one another. I typically like to think cousin, but I can't prove it. And so you see this idea of, if you've ever had a cousin that's really close that you worked on things together with, I'm sure it wasn't as great as this. But then to lose them at a young age, I mean, do you realize how old John the Baptist is when he dies? He's only 6 months behind Jesus. Sometime in his early 30s. You ever lost a cousin in your early 30s? That's not something you're expecting, typically. And to go, here is John's death. And it's because somebody danced real pretty at Herod's birthday party. You know, this doesn't add up. This doesn't make sense in our minds. And yet at the same time, what's the message that Jesus would receive from this? If John's dead, what's it time for? Full speed ahead. Not going to hold back anymore. When the forerunner has been killed, martyred, he says, it's time. And I don't know exactly when this happens. I don't know if there's another 2 years before Jesus' death. I don't know if there's a year and a half. I don't know if there's 2.5 years. Somewhere through there. And going to Jesus, this was, it's time to not hold back anything any longer in terms of going out to the people. And I want you to notice just the very first verse, the next verse, verse 13. It says, now when Jesus heard about John, he withdrew from there in a boat to a secluded place by himself. What did this news do with Jesus? Where did he want to go? Who did he want to be with? He wanted to be by himself. You'll find out. We'll go ahead and look at it here in a second. But he says he wanted to go to a secluded place by himself. There's some news that you learn about where you just don't want to be with other people anymore. We probably say we want to process things. And sure enough, he puts forth this effort. He wants to get up into the mountain to pray. But notice the rest of verse 13. And when the people heard of this, in other words, that he was trying to go away by himself, they followed him on foot from the cities. What will the people not allow? We're not going to give him time. Sometimes this happens to the grieving families. Someone passes away that you love. Funeral services come up. They're surrounded by people. Families come in from all over the place. They're at your house. All of a sudden, you go through all the services of things, and then burial happens, and then slowly the people start to leave to go back to their homes, and then finally comes that moment where you're alone. And you need that moment. Because it's where we really process things. We have to decide, what am I going to do with this? And I want to show you what Jesus wanted to do at this point, but he can't do it yet. Look a little bit further down. Look at verse 23 in the same chapter. He's going to feed the 5,000. Verse 23. After he had sent the crowds away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. And when it was evening, he was there alone. Sometimes when you want to get away, even Jesus isn't allowed to do that because of the people. He wants to be in a secluded place to pray to God, to talk to him, and processing through thinking about John the Baptist is dead. But these 5,000 men show up with women and children. And what does he do first? I'll take care of your need before my own. What does that tell you about the humility of Jesus? In the midst of grieving over someone who is so close to Jesus, he wants to be by himself on the mountain to pray, and yet here come all these people who follow. How inconvenient. He decides, I'll take care of you first. That should tell us something about the heart of Jesus. Where did he get that kind of wisdom? Isn't that wisdom? Selflessness? There's the Jesus we're trying to imitate. Even in the midst of what we would think of as grief, to draw near to God, and to even serve others, if that's what it takes, to get there. To get what he wanted. To be able to pray and talk to his Father. There's the picture of Jesus. That's the King we serve. So what does that tell you about your needs? Do you ever have any needs? Where does Jesus put them? I'll put your needs ahead of my own. We should know that we are beloved and not doubt it. But with no faith, what can you expect from God? Nothing. James 1 talks about it specifically. He shouldn't expect anything from God, let alone just wisdom. So you see this overall picture. And that's kind of what I want us to pull together and go, man, I should never be offended by what God's doing in my life. Because if I am, I'm going to cut myself off from these spiritual blessings in Christ. And you see this picture together. Any comments or any statements you'd like to share? Susan. Right. Striking can hit in a positive or a negative. And you see what it was for those in the synagogue in Nazareth. They were struck by it, but it wasn't something of benefit. Even though they had seen the wisdom, they had heard the wisdom, and to see how it turned out. All right. Have a good rest of your week.